Blog Talk Radio.
The sun go down and lulls us to our sleep. Beloved, who makes the earth so round about the sun to sweep. Mother, who speaks her words in the silent moonlit night above.
Listening to The Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystalyn Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paula and Crystalyn.
What a beautiful day.
I know. It's a beautiful Colorado day, and summer's winding down. You can feel the coolness in the air. We actually had a really cold night the other night, so it's fall is coming, and I love this time of year. It's invigorating to me. Can't wait for the leaves to start to change. It'll be great. But we have a great show today. You know, last week, if you missed our show, I hope you catch it on the archive, because we interviewed Waylon Matthew Fox. And he was wrongfully convicted and spent 17 months in a Texas prison and did some amazing prison ministry in there while he was in there. And he got out on appeal and was exonerated. And today we have actually a friend of Matthew's and someone who is doing remarkable prison ministry in his own right. His name is, yes, you're hearing it right. His name is Bill Sadler, and he is currently ministering to death row inmates in Texas. He's an ordained minister with a doctorate of divinity from St. Mary's Seminary in Houston, Texas. He has a B.S. in psychology, an M.A. in pastoral studies with pastoral counseling, nearly 40 years of personal experience with the Urantia book, and a doctorate of divinity. He is eminently qualified to do ministry to prisoners, and we hope this is going to be a really inspiring show, and we want to hear these stories from Bill on, you know, how he's helped the people who are hopeless, essentially, find peace and love and hope in their eternal career. So, Bill Sadler, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you.
Hi, Paula. Thank you all for inviting me. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to share my experience with this prison ministry.
It has to be amazing. I don't know if you knew this about me, but I also found the Urantia book because my first husband, who died in 1982, found himself incarcerated for gosh, about probably 3 years, 3 or 4 years. And while he was in jail, some people did some outreach, and they gave him the Urantia book, and he consequently gave it to me. And it came to me as the result of a very fervent, sincere prayer for answers. So, I pointed this out last week on the show, too. It's important to remember that even a prisoner has loved ones and friends on the outside, and when he's affected by something that changes his life and his attitude about God and creation, everybody in his circle can be deeply affected as well. I certainly was. So thank you for that ministry.
Oh, you're
very dear
welcome.
To my heart. Very, very dear to my heart. So
Bill,
Go ahead, Kristen.
I was just going to suggest, but Bill, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your earlier life and how you came across the teachings and what motivated you to study ministry.
Okay, well, it's a very lengthy story. I'll try to keep it brief. If I take too much time, just let me know. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church and have always been on a search, a personal search for God and truth. The first question recorded by my mother in her journal about me was I asked a question based in terms of God. The question wasn't directly about God, but it assumed knowledge of God. I asked an unusual question for a toddler who had never voiced a question before. Is Santa Claus a spirit like God? All right? So that was the start of the initial indication of my knowledge and relationship with the Creator, which has proceeded from that point through many different, for what seemed to be many unusual experiences. But I have always been searching. In high school, I was involved in the church choir and started studying the Bible, the Christian Bible, in earnest. Carried the Bible and also copies of the Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital. I was rather eclectic in my view. I was searching for truth wherever I could find it, but I knew that God is the sole source of everything. So he was always my primary goal and purpose in life. If you ask anyone about me during those days or look me up in the archives of the Raven Gat and the Coochie School, it's a Presbyterian high school in northern Georgia, you'll find pictures of me smiling, carrying the Bible and wearing the pectoral cross and the whole bit. After high school, I was married for 8 years, and continued with the Urantia book. Oh, I didn't even tell you about the Urantia book. I'm sorry. When I got to Oklahoma City, I went into business with my dad after the first year in college. I went to Presbyterian College in Clinton, South Carolina for my first year. When I was in Oklahoma City, I was it's a long story, but I did some really in-depth studies of the Book of Psalms and the Bible and Proverbs, and was putting together in my mind the message of Jesus when he said or was quoted in Matthew as, "Be you therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." I was putting that together with the priestly prayer of to the apostles about let us all become one. Father, I pray that they all become perfectly one as you and I are one. Putting that together with the Pauline teaching of all those who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. I put all that together with the Proverbs and Psalms and the many various, they're not entirely clear, but they're leading statements about relationship with God in terms of love and wisdom and purpose. And one proverb stood out to me about commit all that you have to the Lord and he will order your thoughts and direct your steps. Well, putting all that together, this all happened in one night, by the way, this meditative experience, and it went over about the entire night. I developed this concept, which later I learned was very close to the essentials of the description of the thought adjuster, the nature of the thought adjuster. But to me, it was the indwelling spirit. At that point, I had a very remarkable experience. I mean, I would call it a burning bush experience, because that is, at the time, it didn't occur to me that that's what it was, but some 30 years later, I realized, wow, this is kind of similar. I felt as if I was sitting next to a flame. It was like an orb, not quite an orb, more of a drop of golden white flame. It was really, really unique experience. But there was, in my mind, I was going over, God, how can I possibly become perfect? You know, this is a major goal of perfection, to be like you. And
quite the directive.
Boy, howdy, I tell you what. And I don't know that if anybody else was else in the room, if they could have heard it, I don't know. But to me, it was a startling and loud, booming voice. You know, I was saying, could I possibly have time to do this? And this, I heard, you have all the time you need. All right? I mean, it was so startling to me that I turned around and looked over my shoulder, because I thought perhaps somebody had walked into the room and was standing behind me. No, there was nobody standing behind me. But now, how does this relate to your answer book? Well, I burst into tears. That was a very powerful experience for me. I want to say it was the next day, but it could have been a couple of days. You know, time kind of gets compressed in retrospect, but I was taking an employee of ours to a bookstore to find a Bible for his brother. He and I had been studying the Bible. He was much younger than me, but I had been helping him study the Bible. And so I was taking it to find a Bible. While in the bookstore in Oklahoma City, I looked up on the shelf and saw the older version of the Urant book that has the white book jacket with just on the binding, it has just the concentric circle symbol, and it says your answer book. I saw the book. I had never heard of it before. I knew nothing about it. I reached up, pulled it down, flipped it open to the section on the thought adjusters. Started looking through there, saw exactly, you know, the words describing the sorts of experience I had just had. So,
wow.
Needless to say, that book became my personal possession immediately, and everything moved forward from there. I have been a Johnny Appleseed with the Urantia book teachings ever since then. I'm not sure. You all have been around as long as I have, and you may know about Oklahoma City First Urantia Society of Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
That was a part of the old brotherhood back in those days in 1978. That's when all this was happening. And I opened the phone book. There was a card in the old Urantia book with information about the Urantia Brotherhood, which it didn't have any phone numbers. It had an address on there, I think. But I really wanted to know more about this book. I mean, it was a day or so after I had found it, and I had been reading it diligently. I had read the Thought Adjuster papers and had just been going back and forth through the whole thing. Loved the Melchizedek papers. I mean, that's right up my alley. The philosophy and the intellectual stuff. So I picked up the Oklahoma City phone book, opened it up just for fun, see if there was a number, and guess what? First Urantia Society of Oklahoma City was listed in the Oklahoma City phone directory. So I called the number. A lady answered the phone. You know, there was no, she didn't say, hello, this is First Urantia Society of Oklahoma City. It was just, hi, hello. And I said, my name is Bill Sadler. I'd like to find out more about the Urantia book.
Was it Berkeley?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. But she didn't tell me that at first. There was silence. There was just
when you said
silence.
Your name, she probably had a bit of a taken back moment.
Well, you know, I have to interject that Berkeley Elliott, who was the grandmother of the Urantia, you know, group in Oklahoma City and so highly respected and loved by Urantia book readers in Oklahoma and in Oklahoma City. She was close personal friends with Bill Sadler, Dr. Sadler's son. And so I'm sure that made her heart stop.
Yeah, a voice
for a
from
minute.
The grave.
Yeah,
and that was the kind of response. It was complete silence. You know, if I wasn't aware of an open line and still hearing somebody breathing on the other side, I might have hung up and dialed back. So I repeated the question. You know, I said the same thing again. You know, my name is Bill Sadler. I'm interested in finding out more about the Urantia book. She said something like, "You're joking, right?" You know, I didn't know what I had stepped into in all this. I had no idea. So, you know,
that's funny.
One thing led to another, and she explained to me. She said, "You know, Bill Sadler is dead," and I said, "Well, nevertheless, my name is Bill Sadler, and I want to find out more about the Urantia book." So, we set a date, and we met at I think it's called Queen Anne's Cafeteria in Oklahoma City, and we talked. And so I participated in two study groups in Oklahoma City for a while. There was some political things going on with the – I didn't know all the details, but with the Urantia Foundation and the Brotherhood and some things that I didn't particularly agree with. So after meeting some of the movers and shakers like Meredith Sprunger and I believe his name was Larry Mullins. He did a lot of audio-visual stuff. And a number of other people who filled me in on the history of the Urantia book, which I would have never known because there was no internet or anything like in those days. So they told me about Bill Sadler, and Dr. Sadler showed me the book, A Mind at Mischief, and the appendix explained to me what had happened about the some of the experiments Dr. Sadler had done and the sleeping subject and the whole story of the forum and the reception of the Urantia papers. But after I heard all that and saw some of the very legalistic paperwork about the formation of the foundation and the Brotherhood, and I wasn't really happy with the way things were moving. So I stepped aside. I continued with the Urantia book. I've had it with me ever since, and teachings have gone with me everywhere I go. I'm a Johnny Appleseed for sure, if you know the story. And I sprinkle the seeds of truth literally everywhere. Anybody that knows me for a few moments has heard something related to the Urantia book, although they may not know where it's from. And if they get to know me at all very well, they will know about the Urantia book. So I continued through. I got married and went through all the 8 years of marriage, and we lived together at the beginning 2 years before that, getting my degree in psychology. And then after our divorce in 91, I went to I told you I was a Presbyterian, went to St. Mary's Seminary to study Christianity. My goal was to know as much as I could about Christianity, because I was certain that in promulgating the teachings of the Urantia book, it would be greatly beneficial for me to understand in depth the largest and most powerful religion, at least in the United States. Mm-hmm. All right. So that I was thinking of starting a church. It was kind of floating in my mind and this sort of thing. Excuse me. So when I studied the Roman Catholic Church, I came to a realization after reading their documents, the Second Vatican Council and other the churchly material, that they know a lot. I mean, they were pretty much in line with a lot of the teachings of the Urantia book authors, but they didn't even realize it. You know, I shared a lot of the Urantia book with priests and mailed a copy to the Pope, and all sorts of different people examined it in the church and associated with the church, and especially if they didn't know where it was from, they agreed with it entirely. In fact, they were overwhelming with their praise of, I remember the faith and belief section from them, one of the Melchizedek papers, where, I believe it was Melchizedek, where belief has attained the level of faith when it motivates life and shapes the mode of living. The personal English assistant, the personal English secretary for Pope John Paul, read that entire paper and just his mouth dropped open. I mean, he said, "I have never heard it put so well. That is absolutely beautiful." And he was teaching a class, and he went on as he was beginning to teach the class, writing the lesson on the board. He just kept stopping and thinking, "I've never heard anything like that." That's the sort of response I got. Well, I even considered becoming a Roman Catholic priest, but that did not pan out in the long run. I want to correct something. At the beginning, you introduced me as having received my doctorate of divinity from the St. Mary's Seminary. Actually, that is not correct. I received the Master of Arts of Pastoral Studies after going halfway through the priestly formation program, the priestly educational program at St. Mary's Seminary. The Doctor of Divinity was granted by Universal Life Church at the time that I was ordained. That was based on my experience in my educational experience of, I have 72 hours of graduate school in the Roman Catholic Church. And they added me, it's a full Doctorate of Divinity. It's not an honorary doctorate, but it's not from the St. Mary's Seminary. And so I want to be clear about that. It's not a Catholic doctorate.
Thank you.
It is a, you're
thanks
welcome.
For
it's
clarifying.
Sorry
that we got that one wrong.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, any doctorate from the Roman Church is an honor to receive. And so anyway, I have carried the Urantia book with me everywhere I go, and now I do carry it into a maximum security prison several times a week at this point. You know, it's having an effect there, too.
Well, here's something I think is important for people to know, and many of our listeners who are listening today and maybe who will listen in the future from the archive will maybe come away thinking, well, you know, I could do prison ministry. But that's not necessarily true, is it? I mean, it's not an easy nut to crack to be able to get into prisons and do ministry, at least from my experience.
You're absolutely right. Now, I can't tell from the voices exactly who was saying that. Was that Paula or was that
Crystal? Paula. That's Paula.
You're right, Paula. It is not easy. And when I first, if you want to visit a prisoner in prison, you must be on their visitation list. A person cannot just walk into the prison and say, "Hey, I want to visit a prisoner." You already have to know someone, and they have to know you. And there have to have been steps taken to go on a visitation list, which is not, I learned, it is not straightforward. Here in Texas, they can only alter their personal visitors list once every 6 months on death row. So unless you happen to be fortunate and find that they hadn't altered it in the previous 6 months, you know, then you're going to be waiting some time to get on a regular visitation list. In my case, I was looking at the ministerial requirements, and they are different. I can, as a minister does not have to be on a prisoner's visitation list. So all I have to do is know of a prisoner and go into the prison with their personal Texas Department of Criminal Justice identification number and their name, and they'll call them. And as long as they're willing, they'll come visit me. But to get on the spiritual advisors list, to be a minister, you have to have ministerial credentials. Were it not that I am ordained, I would not have been able to register as a spiritual advisor in Texas. So that process of being approved, in my case, it took well over a month. I mean, there were some problems with the chaplain's office that held it up. I mean, on their end, they lost the paperwork, and then the chaplain's wife was hospitalized, and these things held the process up. But on top of all that, the head warden of the prison had to personally approve my acceptance as a spiritual advisor, which they are.
Wow.
They've had some trouble over the years with people masquerading as so-called spiritual advisors in order to get in and see many prisoners and then doing things they should not have done. So they're very strict. And so, yes, Paula, you're right. It is not an easy thing to get into a prison at all. And then you have to have a clean record. I mean, a person with any felonies or problems in their past, from my understanding, they would not be allowed into the prison at all.
So
this might be a little bit of a divergent type of question, but I'm curious, what are some of the problems that they've had with people either masquerading as ministers or people who were ministers who had an agenda that wasn't beneficial? What are some of the examples of problems that come up from that?
Well, I haven't been told. I've been told only of a couple. The prison officials do, they're their own government. They do very much whatever they want. So if there is a problem in any way whatsoever, they can say, hey, we're just not going to allow this anymore. I mean, if someone wants to fight it in the court system and say, well, you're supposed to, perhaps it could be won over through the courts, but basically they just call the shots. From what I'm told, what was happening is friends of prisoners who were not actually ministers were using the spiritual advising program to gain additional visits with their loved ones is what was happening. Mm-hmm. You know, they would use their personal visits, which if a person is not on any sort of restriction, in death row they can have one visitor a week. Excuse me. So they were coming and visiting their prisoner, their friend or their loved one once every week, and then they were using the spiritual advisor route to come an additional twice a month. That I know was one of the issues. There was also something mentioned about, and I don't really know the details of the second, so I'm just going to say there was some problems with a so-called minister becoming involved in matters they should have not been involved in. And that I don't want to go any further on that because I don't know.
Personal matters kind of thing, probably, huh?
Yeah.
Personal matters. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
So you're in the, this is Paula, you're in the Texas prison system. Probably every state is different, and I'm sure federal has different regulations, but I would imagine that, and I think you bring up a very good point, that they're kind of their own government, and what rights do prisoners have, and what money do they have to fight anything in court? You know, I mean, they're at the total disadvantage, so there isn't much they could do to mm-hmm. change things. But I imagine that if they're going to approve you to be a minister, they want you to be from one of the traditions that they know of and that are recognized. Is that true?
Yes, it is. I'm told they have a list of 30 recognized faiths. I do not know if the Urantia movement is listed. I was approved under the Interfaith Church, or the Universal Life Church, which has previously gone to federal courts to stand up and be confirmed as a valid and real religious organization. And so, you know, I know they've been approved by the federal courts. As a Universal Life or minister, I'm afforded all ministerial credentials. And so, as I know, every country in the world, and certainly every state in the United States. But I have, in dealing with the Urantia book, and when we get further into the story about the prisoners, you'll understand this more, but they already knew something about the Urantia book because of the effect the message has had on some of the very most violent offenders there at the prison. So when I brought it in, I just called the people in the warden's office, the secretaries who do the scheduling, and had them confirm with the warden that it was going to be all right, that I would be presenting the branch of information, and they had absolutely no problem with that. So,
wow.
Yeah, you have to fit, and it would be mostly, but I will add just a little caveat to that. They even include the Church of Satan on their list of approved ministers. Yeah, so they're pretty open as far as who they'll allow in. They're trying to, and they have to go by the way the Supreme Court views religion, and the Supreme Court is extremely open on their view of religion. Mm-hmm. It's, you know,
I was going to ask that. You know, it seems, you know, nobody would willingly probably allow the Church of Satan to send a minister, but I imagine after court rulings, they more or less have to.
That's right. In fact, one of the prisoners that I'm working with, who was one of the two most violent prisoners in death row in Texas, was a member of the Church of Satan and the Aryan Brotherhood and all the different groups that you can imagine. And so, yes, they do send the ministers in there, and they do have a very negative effect after their visits, too. The unpleasant things tend to start happening. So, But, Paula, it is there are certain limits on who can go in, but I think, like Andre has pointed out, if someone is a member of a religious group and really wants to push the issue, they're going to let any bona fide religious group in there. I mean, even if they're as bizarre as the Church of Satan, they let them in.
Well, let me ask you this then. Could a woman go and minister to male inmates?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, okay. the majority of the visitors and pen pals who are in there are women. They are.
Oh, okay.
And many of them travel. I was surprised to learn they come from all over the world, the Texas Death Row. That these people who have been pen pals with death row prisoners, they can get names of prisoners off the Internet, and then they start corresponding with them. And there are people who regularly, obviously wealthy people, who regularly come over from Europe, particularly England, and they'll visit with death row prisoners here. Most are women. Most are women. I mean, and there are, and I'll tell you more as we go on through this. There is really a need for the people to come visit because the chaplains won't even go talk with the death row prisoners. They have no ministerial input at all. I mean, they're on their own. The only time
why is that?
I have no idea. None.
Is it because going to die, you think? Is it because they're done with, so why bother with them? They have no hope, no future anyway?
I honestly would be totally speculating because I spoke with one of their chaplains there, and he just frankly told me that, you know, we don't have anything to do with the death row prisoners until the day of their execution.
Wow.
And then they show up and they start with, you know, they have a Catholic priest who's one of their chaplains, and then they have Protestants, and they show up and they do their last rites or whatever. You know, they'll do all that. But before that, they've never seen them. And there are some horrible stories about Polonsky. I mean, the prisoners don't appreciate that either. I'll put it to you that way. One chaplain had their arm ripped off on the way to the execution, arm severed by the prisoner. That's on the Internet. You can find that story. So the prisoners aren't happy with this. The prisoners aren't happy with being left on their own at all. They're searching. They need people to help them. And I know I'm moving away from answering your specific question. Many of them have been searching through the holy texts like the Quran and the Bible and the many world religions and spiritual health spells. Self-help books and all this sort of thing, but they're not finding any personal satisfaction there. They're not finding the answers to their questions. When they found the Urantia book, when it showed up there not more than a couple of years ago, they began to have their questions answered in a palatable, a believable, relatively a non-contradictory, straightforward, truthful manner. And so they began to find meaning to their existence again and started digging deeper. And, well, we'll move on. When we get to that point, I'll explain you more about that.
Well, I would like to read something just really quick because it just seems like it's the perfect time to do it. It's from the Urantia book. It's from The Life and Teachings of Jesus, paper 133. And it's when Jesus was doing private ministry about Rome and the Mediterranean, he said something to a condemned criminal. And this is just one paragraph from The Life and Teachings of Jesus. To the condemned criminal, he said at the last hour, "My brother, you have fallen on evil times. You lost your way. You became entangled in the meshes of crime. From talking to you, I well know you did not plan to do the thing which is about to cost you your temporal life. But you did do this evil, and your fellows have adjudged you guilty. They have determined that you shall die. You and I may not deny the state this right of self-defense in the manner of its own choosing. There seems to be no way of humanly escaping the penalty of your wrongdoing. Your fellows must judge you by what you did. But there is a judge to whom you may appeal for forgiveness, and who will judge you by your real motives and better intentions. You need not fear to meet the judgment of God if your repentance is genuine and your faith sincere. The fact that your error carries with it the death penalty imposed by man does not prejudice the chance of your soul to obtain justice and enjoy mercy before the heavenly court. I wanted to throw that out there simply because it shows us that Jesus did minister, did take time to minister to even a condemned criminal, and wanted to give this man hope. Maybe nothing for this life, but for the next life. Mm-hmm. And that is why I think, in essence, a prisoner would take great comfort from the Urantia book. Because oftentimes we think just because our human associates have found us valueless, that means that our unseen friends find us valueless too.
Mm-hmm. But and I think to take that a step further, so many people, so many young people, even children, grow up in environments where they are told they are worthless from their earliest days, or they are punished so severely, or they're, you know, abused in the name of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's something that happens a lot in families who are confused about the nature of God and the nature of the responsibility of family and parenting.
Absolutely true. Yeah, that's a beautiful example, Paula, of the teachings of Christ, the teachings of Jesus about taking care of those in need, and particularly with the prisoners. I mean, they are people too. They have potential of eternal survival, as you pointed out. Even if the earthly authorities have condemned them, that doesn't take away their value as a child of God. I mean, they made serious mistakes, and they still have the opportunity to make the right choices and move ahead. I mean, the options are always open, you know, unless they just totally refuse. I mean, they're open. They can move on. They do have value, and they are many of the prisoners, Crystalin, indeed, one of the problems is their upbringing. I mean, they have developed a great distaste for religion. One of my prisoners, Chris, who is has a nickname Cujo after the rabid dog in Stephen King's novels, because of the history he has of taking the offensive to start with, to attack first and maybe think about asking questions later. He told me stories of being beaten in the name of Jesus as he was growing up. He was raised by supposedly religious fundamentalists. They didn't sound very religious to me, but they were fundamentalist parents, and he went to a fundamentalist church school in the South. And here in Houston, a school that still exists, where they did abuse the kids in the name of religion, in the name of God, and Chris had grown to literally hate the person he had been told was Jesus, largely because, in my opinion, from his stories, he was beaten so many times, and that's what they were saying as they were beating him. You know, this is beating in the name of Jesus, you know, like they were exorcising some sort of evil spirits from him or something. You know, that's what I got out of what he said. But, we have a situation with the way children are brought up. It's critical. And these prisoners have taken the brunt in many cases of that sort of an upbringing and have a great misunderstanding of who Jesus is. You know, Chris thought of Jesus as the man of sorrows who was a weakling, and he had just totally, even after years of church school upbringing. He had a totally skewed view of Jesus. He had no idea of the person that the Urantia book authors tell us about in the story of Michael, the Paradise Creator son, when he was here as Joshua ben Joseph. The stories are similar, but as all of us here know, they are not exactly the same as those in the Bible. We get much more insight and enlightenment as to the true nature of the Son of Man, Son of God, a man of strength and power and authority, who was a man of love and kindness and mercy. You know, this is not a person who's going to be beating his children, you know, in the name of God or something like that. So these prisoners, many of them are at a disadvantage because of the parenting, because of the culture in which they were brought up. But ultimately, and they do admit, those who are sincere realize that they're in their situation because of the many, many, many very bad decisions they made along the way. Chris,
you mentioned Chris or Cujo, and he ended up being really the thread that brought you into that penitentiary. Maybe you can tell us that story.
Oh, sure. I had been part of one of the fellowship-sponsored study groups here. It's actually listed in Huntsville, Texas. Cal Weatherford and her husband, Skip, have sponsored a study group for apparently a long time. I hadn't been involved in it for that long. But they were contacted. Carol was contacted via an internet search someone had done on Chris's behalf. A nursing student in Victoria, Texas, had begun searching for Chris. Chris had shown a great deal of interest in the Urantia book. She contacted Carol Weatherford. Carol called me and told me of the need. Someone was asking questions. I hope I'm answering the question you were asking
I wanted to ask, first of all, how Chris found the book to begin with.
How he found the book was basically accidentally. He had, somewhere along the line, he had heard of the name of the Urantia book prior, but when he was they're all in solitary confinement on death row in Houston. They brought a book to him and set it in his lap. It was not actually, as it turns out, it was not intended for him. It was intended for another prisoner who was no longer there. But Chris obtained the book, and he was not interested in looking at it because it said something about Jesus on the front of it. So he had just stuffed it. They don't throw anything away in death row, so I'm told. Everything has some sort of value. So if something comes their way, they hang on to it. They find a way to use it. So he had put it on his desk, and it sat there for quite some time. Chris had been studying religious works. He's one of those who's been searching all his life, but without any satisfaction. He had been brought up in the as I explained just a few moments ago, in the fundamentalist, I believe it was the Baptist church, and had been taught of the God of wrath and hellfire and damnation, the idea that, you know, Jesus was the sacrifice that was supposed to appease an angry God so that he would not vent his wrath upon erring children, you know, or non-erring children who had nothing to do with an original sin that supposedly occurred some distant ancient time in the past. He had no real knowledge of Christianity, but he knew what he knew, and he did not like it. So he had studied all of the Buddhism, the Hinduism, the Islam. He could tell you about just about all the world religions, and various self-help books, psychobabble sort of stuff. But nothing filled the bill. So now here's what happened. He had the book, but he wouldn't look at it because on the front of it, it talked about the life and teachings of Jesus, which he had grown to. He'll tell you he hated the whole idea of Jesus, the one he knew. All right, not the real one, but Jesus, as he had been taught. ultimately one day, and if I understand correctly, he was in a situation where he had, had things taken away from him. They do disciplinary actions every now and then. But he was just extremely bored. He was in his cell.
Wasn't he not only in solitary confinement, but wasn't he in even his own separate unit because he was so violent?
Yes, ma'am. That's part of Chris's story, although that part doesn't have anything to do with the acquisition of the Urantia book. Chris was so very violent. I mentioned about his nickname of Cujo. They were afraid of him. He would attack any way he could, and he was always preparing and ready for attacking. He had very many ingenious ways of wreaking havoc and harm on people. I mentioned he was a member of the Church of Satan, and you know their whole scheme is to do as much harm as you can to confuse and disrupt and corrupt and do everything possible to cause problems. So he was on his own personal holy war in the negative sense. So they had him in a cell that was set apart, a unit of his own. He was housed in a cell much like Hannibal Lecter's in The Silence of the Lambs, from what it's been described to me. It's plexiglass with the air holes and the little tray you slide in and out to get things in and out, and a massive restraints if you're going to move somebody from one place to another. Because, again, he'll admit he would attack them any way he possibly could. Now, I'm not suggesting he was a cannibal or anything like Hannibal Lecter, but he would attack them, and they knew it. So that, yes, Crystal, and that was a big part of Chris. And this is one reason his conversion is so powerful and influence on all the other prisoners and the authorities here at Polunsky Unit, because they knew what he was and what he did and had been for so very many years, okay?
The transformation was so startling. It was just so startling.
Yes.
His transformation,
It was beyond anything they could have imagined possible. I mean, they've been there for decades, and they've seen religious ministers come and go with religions from all over the world, and they don't see this sort of thing. They don't see this sort of a transformation where this guy with a tattoo of Adolf Hitler on his back and demons all over his body and member of the Church of Satan, nicknamed Cujo, who they knew would attack at the least opportunity he would take to attack anything and everything. So he said if they tried to handle them, he would attack them. I mean, that was basically what he told me. He accidentally received the Urantia book, was very bored one day, and finally opened it up and said, "I'll just not look at the Jesus papers." And he started reading the beginning, from the beginning. And he couldn't put it down. He kept reading. And he said he just literally, he could not put it down. He nonstop read all the way through. And I don't know if it was all in one day. I doubt that. But, you know, nonstop read that book and kept telling himself, well, when I get to the last section, the Jesus papers, I'm just not going to read it. You know, I know about the person they talk about is Jesus. But when he got there, he said, "Oh, well, you know, maybe I'll just go ahead and look at this anyway. I'm really, really getting something out of the rest of this book." So he did. He did. He read it all the way through and just could not. He could not. I don't know how to describe Chris, and you'd have to meet him, but he could not grasp what was going on. I mean, he knew there was something happening with him. So he read it again, and he began to put into practice the teachings presented by the authors of the Urantia book and the examples of Jesus Christ. He started practicing what he was learning and saw the change within himself. So he then started getting concerned. Then, you know, he had pretty well burned out his conscience, and he was just, I suppose, you know, you hear about those, they say, who choose so frequently to disobey the will of God that the thought adjusters, and I believe it talks about the Ancients of Days, but they just decide that there's not even the possibility this person is going to choose properly, and the thought adjuster parts. And my impression is he was closing in on that realm. So he was burnt out. He didn't have any – he was concerned when he came to me. He said, I don't have any feeling. I mean, I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. It feels fine. So, you know, to me, it sounds like there was a burning out of the conscience. He was approaching actual complete death sort of a situation.
Mm.
But
soul death.
Soul death, exactly, as the Revelation in the Bible talks about the second death, the final death. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to find out. That's why he came. That's why he was searching for somebody to answer some questions. That's why he got in touch with me. Because he wanted to find out if he had any potential, if there was any value, if there was any hope left for him. He had
a pen pal on the outside who had access to the internet, who looked up the Huntsville Study Group, and then Carol contacted you to see if you would be interested.
She contacted me telling me that there was a prisoner who was asking questions about the Urantia book, and would I be willing to talk with him, all right?
Did you know at the time that he was on death row?
I don't remember, quite frankly. I'll answer anybody's questions as long as they're sincere, so it didn't stand out to me. I knew he was a prisoner. Now, as soon as the pen pal actually contacted me, then I did know he was on death row. That was one of the first things that was mentioned. Again, the whole prison thing, other than the idea of, you know, when you do this to the least of these, my brethren, you do this unto me from the Bible and similar in your Esther book, that wouldn't have made any difference to me. I mean, if somebody's asking questions about your Esther book, I'm going to answer them. It was an interesting situation that it was in the prisons, you know, because I'm a minister and I'm always interested in doing ministry. So this is something I've never done. I've never been on the inside of a state penitentiary. I mean, so, I was interested in answering the questions. I was interested in sharing the message of the Urantia book. And the idea of a prison ministry appealed to me also. So when she told me of his need, we started corresponding. She got my address from me, and he wrote me a letter and asked me questions about what I just mentioned about his is there any hope for him, you know? And so I began to answer his questions, and I explained to him that there's always hope. The very fact that he is asking if there is hope shows that there is hope, and
the flicker of faith.
Exactly. In fact, that was precisely the terminology that I used repeatedly, and I used Jesus's statement about dare to believe. I mean, we've got to believe, and I helped him up out of the abyss, and he began to see. He believed. He put that belief into practice. He exercised faith. And he has begun to, there are many ways I could put this, but let us say he has the twinkle in the eye and the sincere desire to do good to others and is all going all over. You know how new readers of the Urantia book are, that share it with everybody. And he is doing that. He is sharing it with everyone.
He's a missionary evangel inside death row.
Is he allowed in the general population at all? Are death row prisoners allowed in the general?
No, they are not. They are in solitary confinement. Now, solitary confinement for death row is just means they don't have direct physical contact with anybody else. It's not like they're in a teeny little cubicle, you know, shut off from the world and stripped of all their clothes. And unless they're on the punishment on FPOD, that's a different situation. But they have an 8x12. Their cell is 8x12 with the basic amenities of a prison cell. But they can't directly contact other prisoners. Not really. I mean, the only time they can even talk with other prisoners is they have outdoor recreation. Well, it's sort of outdoor. Describe it to me. I haven't seen it. I haven't asked for a tour yet, and I don't know if the authorities will allow me to do that, but I'm going to ask. They have a room that has no roof, but it has walls, and there's a fence in the middle of it solid steel fence that on either side of it, there are two areas where they have basketball hoops and weight benches and things like that, where they'll put one death row prisoner on each side. So they're out there for 2 hours together, and that is the only time that they are really able to talk with each other.
Wow.
And that's a couple of times a week. Don't quote me on the length of time there, but I know it's 2 hours is my understanding on that. Two or three times a week they're out there. Beyond that, the only communication with other prisoners is yelling from cell to cell. I mean, that's it.
Uh-huh.
That's it. Which they are allowed to holler to each other from cell to cell. They're not restricted in that sense. But so I was just explaining about solitary confinement doesn't mean, at least what I used to think of solitary confinement, which was really, you know, in a dark hole and totally solitary. That's not exactly what that means. But they are alone and they are highly restricted. You know, they get nothing. They don't even get medical care. If they are offered the opportunity to buy essentially a medical insurance program, it's not expensive, but they have to pay for it. Same with dental, and they're given the three very, very rudimentary meals a day, and that is it. That is it. You know, and their clothes, of course.
I want to let Andre jump in here because I'm sure he has a question, but I want to ask real quickly, how old is Chris and how long has he been on death row?
Chris is he's about 10 years younger than me. He's around 45, if I got it. I got 45 or 46, and he's
okay.
Actually been on death row for 7 years.
Wow. Okay. Andre, I know you must have a question.
Well, I'm just listening in fascination, and I really, really enjoyed, reading the story in preparation for this show with Bill. The idea of ministering, these two stories are tremendously dramatic. As I was going through, one of the things that struck me in what we were talking about initially is the idea that this is not a cakewalk for people to undertake, and you can't just go about doing it. But yet I can imagine that we have people tuning in that may be moved to, in their particular area, wherever they are. I mean, there are 50 states in this union and many, many counties in these states, and you are ministering largely in one place, and there are, I'm sure, plenty of places where there could be this kind of ministry going on. I guess my question is, how would a person really start in order to get themselves ready for this if they're thinking about this seriously, if they feel called to this kind of ministry, Bill?
Well, if we're speaking of the Urantia book, then
yeah,
they're either going to be going as a regular visitor or they're going to need to get themselves ordained, which they can do, but they'll have to choose a church to ordain them because they require credentials in order to operate as a minister.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important is to know the material. I mean, these people, all the prisoners have a lot of questions. They don't. I go in wanting them to ask me questions. I'll answer their questions. I don't go in giving a sermon or preaching to them. That they don't want that. I mean, they have that. They've got ministers. They've got all sorts of religious faith. Most of the religious faith, primarily fundamentalist Christian, come in there, and they do a lot of preaching to them, and it's a lot of the Bible verses and this sort of thing. And they don't really want that. I'm sure there's some that might benefit from that, but they want someone who can come in and answer their questions about the teachings of the Urantia book. So for someone to be really interested in carrying the message of the Urantia book to prisoners in death row or in general population, number one is thoroughly know the material. But be sure to have read the entire Urantia book and have studied it and have lived it. Be in touch with your superconscious, be in touch with God within, and as much as possible, you know, on top of the situation. You don't walk in there thinking that I'm going to, you know, I don't know how to put it. Know the book, know the material. That's number one. Then you need to find a prisoner. I mean, that's going to be a daunting challenge in itself, because there are people, quite a few, who would respond to inquiries if you go on the internet and find. I know I haven't looked myself, but I'm told there are websites, and doing a Google search would put you in touch with prisoners, particularly death row prisoners. But they're not all there for good purposes. I mean, they may say they're searching for God or truth or whatever, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are. So they are capable, and I know some certainly would take every advantage possible. So being wise as a serpent yet harmless as a dove comes to mind here. And knowing who you're dealing with, it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, in my situation, I had people, the nurse who contacted me had already befriended and had known Chris via correspondence for some time. So I had some personal references before I went into the prison. And now that I'm in there, the other prisoners are helping me to discern who is really interested and who is not. Now, I have pretty good discernment myself, and I've had to end advising with several, because it became clear they're not there for finding God and becoming like Him. They're there for getting out of the cell and having a little snack while they chat, and that's not what I'm there about. So the point being, finding someone that needs the ministry is going to be a challenge. Working with someone else already involved in the ministry would be the number one way to do it. And the Urantia movement, unfortunately, doesn't have a lot of people doing this. If somebody really is involved with a religious community, particularly a Christian religious community, there are many Christian communities that do have prison ministries, and someone could become associated or affiliated with one of those groups and visit prisons. Often they'll carry a van load of people up to various prisons and allow for ministry. I mean, that would be a way to do it. And if they want to, that's in my area. I'm here, and anybody can feel free to contact me. But it's preparation in the sense of knowing the material, knowing God, really actively being sincerely on the search to find God and become like Him, knowing the teachings of the Urantia Book authors, having access to a prisoner or a group of prisoners, you know, knowing about them and being prepared, being wise, not, you know, walking into it without blinders on. Don't think that this is going to be an easy, straightforward task, because these people are, particularly in death row, they're there for a reason. I mean, there are a number of them, about half of them, and this is sort of an aside, but half of them are first-time offenders. All right, it's a sad situation here in Texas. I mean, it seems, I don't like that the first-time offender would be on death row. That means it was generally a crime of passion, an error that was made. But also, on their behalf, I will say that in Texas, there is a law called the Law of Parties. So there are many of these men on death row, and we have a small woman population in another prison, are on death row because they happen to be accompanying someone who committed a capital murder. So they might not have even, and some of these guys I'm talking with did not themselves actually commit a murder. They just happened to be there along with a person that did. So knowing the people you're working with, knowing the material, I hope that helped answer the question. It's not an easy. It came to me. I mean, God brought this to me, and I responded to the questions. I mean, that's pretty much how my life goes. You know, I guess that's how the Urantia Book got here too. I mean, they started asking questions, and the questions got answered.
Well, Bill, what are some of the pitfalls, though? What should, now, if somebody, suppose that they meet all the prerequisites, they know the material, their heart's in the right place, they are ordained, and they start out to do this ministry, what do they need to watch out for? I mean, is it just, like you said, they're there for a reason, so be real, real careful?
If we're talking death row ministry, see, the many states don't have death row. I mean, I can't say how many do, how many don't, but I'm sure you all are aware of that. Texas is one of the most frequent users of the death penalty. So we have 300 prisoners. This is the death row facility for Texas, by the way. We have 300 prisoners here that are on death row awaiting execution. There's a difference between how one would deal with and the pitfalls of dealing with death row or a general population scenario. In death row, it's there on one side. When I visit with them, they bring them in shackles, all right? They put them in a booth. It's almost, it might as well be in another room. I mean, they're on the other side of a wall that has a plexiglass window, thick one, all right? They sit them down in a seat. They close the door, lock the door. The prisoner has to put their hands with the handcuffs through a slot on the door for them to unlock the handcuffs, all right? The point is that in this sort of a situation, I'm very protected. I am.
Mm-hmm.
As a minister, there's not going to be anything that these prisoners are going to, if I was to get a bad seed, there's nothing they could do to harm me, all right? I'm safe. In general population, that's not the case because those are full contact visits, so they'll put you in a room full of families and other prisoners, and anything is possible. So there's different pitfalls there. In death row, you don't have to worry about your personal safety. In general population, that is a concern because there's nobody.
You mentioned somebody's sincerity level, and I just wonder, do you discern that because they're asking you to do something ultimately that you shouldn't do, and that's how you know they're trying to use you to get something they want?
In at least one case, that has been the fact. It really, their interest level in the material and their interest level in the Urantia book and in God are very, very good indicators. Those who have turned out to be there for ulterior motives, they'll say or do things that they won't know the material. You know, they'll say, well, I'm reading your Urantia book, but when you start talking about it, they pretty clear they really don't know anything about
it.
So you can see that they're not sincerely interested. There are some who say they're interested in the Urantia book because they've heard about me and they know about Chris, and hopefully we'll get to talk more about Chris and the other prisoners. But they know that I'm there because of Chris. Chris is high profile, and the changes that he's gone through are very well known by all the death row inmates and the authorities at the prison. So they hear about him, and they've had several have come to me thinking, well, they're going to get that couple of hours out of their cell. Their cells are really not air conditioned. They're chillers. They're hot, and they bring them for the discussions, interviews, visits is air conditioned, and they're no longer sitting in their cell. They're out of the cell, and I'll get them a snack. It's normal procedure for visitors. They're on the road to go to the vending machines and buy them a snack. They don't get good food, so the salads and watermelon and Cokes and things that I purchase out of the machines for them, that's a pretty big deal. And then actually able to sit down and talk with somebody, which I explained the only way they get to do that is during that recreation period, and they have no selectivity about who they're talking with. And it could be one of 299 other people that they know or they don't know or like or don't like. Here, at least they have some choice.
Right.
Now, can you bring food into the facility, or can you only buy food from the vending machine?
Only from the vending machines. You can't bring anything in. In fact, that is a problem. That is a pitfall. It's not a danger, but you can't bring a pen. You can't bring a pencil. You can bring nothing except your car keys. And if you're a minister, you can bring your holy book. A visitor cannot bring a book. Yeah, a visitor cannot even bring a book. So there's nothing. They let me bring in a bag of $25, a clear plastic bag with $25 of coins. Susan B. Anthony dollars is what they prefer, but they'll allow quarters, and that's it. That's it.
Now, what? Just so you can use the vending machines? That's why you bring the coins?
Yes. Now, they do also, on select days during the week, the officers will take photographs, and they'll, for $3 a photograph, they'll take a picture of the visitor and the prisoner. But that's it. That's all.
Hmm. Well, we had a question on the board, too. Can any of the inmates, would it be even possible for any of the inmates to hear this broadcast?
No. They are not allowed internet access. They have no internet access whatsoever. They can purchase from the commissary. They have the funding. They can purchase a small transistor radio, old-timey style transistor radio. But that's it. That's it. Everything that they have, they have to buy. And they're high. From what I've been told, they're items that are basically purchased at a discount market, like Walmart. And then they double or triple the price, and they sell it to the commissary. So that's
oh boy,
yeah.
Mm. So that was really helpful, Bill, to know that what they might want from you is not really contraband or anything illegal, but they just want time out of their cell. I totally understand that. I mean, you know, like I said at the beginning, my husband was incarcerated, and sometimes the everything gets reduced down to the most basic needs, like a little moment in the sunshine or, as you said, a piece of watermelon, you know, because so many things that we take for granted every day are completely gone out of their lives. So that's comforting to know. And I would like to hear more about Cujo and maybe some of the other prisoners that you've dealt with, that you've really seen a transformation. You know, last week Matthew shared some poems written by prisoners, and we were all inspired by the ministry that he did while he was there, which obviously afforded him an opportunity to really do some real, you know, hands-on ministry right now and in an ongoing way. And but love to hear some of those stories.
I want to interject something because I know that you are personal friends with Matthew. And so you may be able to help answer a question that I forgot to ask last week. But since preparing for the show, I have watched a few documentaries and I've also done some research on the conditions in prisons around the country, but especially in Texas. And one of the things I found out was that, you know, sex offenders, people who are in prison for sex offenses, especially if they've been accused of any kind of involvement with a child, that they are pretty much on a hit list from the moment they arrive. And I know that Matthew was in county jail, right, rather than in the prison system?
My understanding. Now, Matthew and I are friends. We don't really know each other that well. We both attended the Carol Weatherford study group a couple of times together. So Matthew, when he saw my GoFundMe announcement on Facebook and learned about this ministry, with the background he has in prison and prison ministry, was very anxious to help me. But what I'm saying is I don't know all that much about Matthew. But what I do know, and I can answer your question, is that he was in Harris County jail is where he was. And, yes, there is a tendency, even on death row, for those who have been involved in sex crimes, particularly those involving young people, children in particular, they're targeted in a sense. I don't know how far that goes. And in death row, I'm not aware, I haven't heard stories of anybody being killed by other prisoners. I'm sure it must happen, just judging from the type of people that are there. But
I've heard of it happening a lot. And so if you don't know the answer to this, I'll have to wait till we have him back on our program, and I'm hoping that we may still have him call in before we end this series. But I'm impressed that he became known sort of as a holy man rather than as a potential child molester. even though he was, of course, as you know, he was exonerated of that crime or that accusation. But the people that he was in cell with, because he was in a cell with, I think, eight, sometimes 10 other people, they came to respect him for his personal spiritual commitment. And apparently they left him alone when he needed his meditation time. And it seemed like that was an unusual situation given what he had been accused of.
Well, you know, that I think you bring up a good myth, maybe, Crystalline, that and about, you know, how sex offenders per se are treated versus, you know, armed robbers. And I wonder, Matthew, do you have any sense of that? Are some of these just Hollywoodized or sensationalized myths about prison life? Or things that we've heard urban legends say, or is there any truth to that? Do you notice that certain prisoners get treated worse just because of the crime they're in there for?
Are you talking to me? You said Matthew, and I don't know. You
I'm
mean
sorry.
Bill.
Yes, I'm sorry, Bill.
That's okay.
Matthew on the mind.
I am sorry. Yes.
That's all right. I will say this, that There is a stigma attached to the sex crimes. I'm aware of that. I don't know. They're all on death row. They're convicted of some fairly heinous offenses all around. Some of them being said that they're also law of party sort of convictions. But I am seeing two that are the others are always talking negatively about. And all I can see from my conversations with them is the only real difference in the personality, the way they behave in relating to me and talking about the Urantia book and their sincerity and all that, is that one was involved in a sex crime and the other they considered a snitch, all right?
Mm.
So those are two mm-hmm. types of behaviors that, yes, there is a stigma attached to, and, yes, they don't like, and they do, you know, unthinkingly continue to put down with this, mm-hmm. some of these. I can't see a good reason. In other words, talking to these men, the one who was involved in sex crimes and the one who was known generally as, well, they call him a snitch is what they call him. The difference between the men is only that stigma. The guys, you know, they're as sincere and into the message of the Urantia book and trying just as hard as these who are just serial murderers, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Just, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, they're,
right.
Yeah, they're certain crimes, and the sex crimes seem particularly to have a stigma attached to them.
Well, and because you're in the maximum security death row portion of the prison, you really don't, you're not really interacting with the general population culture. It's a different culture on death row.
That's true.
Because they don't have enough access to each other to be able to do harm to each other when they're in death row.
It's much more true on death row than in general population. You are correct.
And they don't have much hope for release, right?
On death row, it's much reduced, yes. On general population, they know at some point they're going to get released. I mean, even those on life terms, my understanding is, you know, even a life term has a physical limit. After a given number of years, they're going to get released, with some exceptions. Mm-hmm. On death row, unless they have a pardon or something like that, they're not going anywhere. I mean, except off the planet. I mean, that's it. Some of them hope that the courts will find in their favor. They all go through a very lengthy appeals process.
Mm-hmm.
The law requires that they go through a very lengthy. appeals process. Some of them have been there 30 years going through appeals process. Yeah. So, but their hopes are much lower, I'm sure, than those. Well, I can't be sure of that. I would think that they would be more accepting of the reality of the situation in death row, that they made the final mistake, and the probability is they're not, at best, they're not ever leaving a prison, at very best. I mean, Chris is an unusual example in that he really didn't even fight. He knew his history. He knew the extent of his crimes. He even attacked the people in the courtroom. And so he has not really the appeals. He just let it run its process. So his 7 years there in death row is a fairly short period of time. And he had given up. I mean, he had not planned to leave. I mean, he had even established, and this is how I found out about GoFundMe, he established a GoFundMe webpage through his pen pal where he was asking for money to help pay for his cremation, because they charged the prisoners' families for the cremation of the prisoners. And he wanted his family to forego that. His article was that, you know, he knew he had done these horrible things, and all he expected was total annihilation, and, you know, he was hopeful that there was not going to be eternal torture and punishment, but that he just wanted to get it over with. And so, you know, he didn't fight. So his 7 years is a short period of time, and his hopes were fairly dashed till he found the Urantia book. And once
is
he studied it, you know,
When's his execution date?
Final date has not yet been set. He's in his final appeal right now. It's gone to the Supreme Court of the United States. They're deciding right now if they're going to hear his final appeal. Large law firm, the Waxman Law Firm in Washington, D.C., was persuaded by Chris's local attorney to consider handling his case with the Supreme Court, and they decided that this would be their pro bono case, and so they presented the request to the Supreme Court to hear an appeal based on some mishandling of Chris's case by one of the attorneys that was appointed to represent him, who actually did not do his job. I was told what he did and what he didn't do, and he just really didn't do his job. Now, Chris does not have any expectation that this means he's going to no longer, that he's going to be freed from the penalty of death, because there are just too many instances, you know, that are out there, too many things he did. So
he freely admits that he was guilty of all the things he was charged with. Is that correct?
Yes, that is my understanding. Yes, he is very and more. So, you know, the way they do it is they'll pick out the most recent or the most extreme, and that's what they'll charge him with, and they don't even bother fooling with the rest of it. So, you know, by Texas state law, I believe they would call him a serial killer. To me, it means something different. To me, a serial killer is someone who does something. You know, they repeatedly do the same thing, the same traditional, stereotypical method of killing people, and they do you know, 20 or 30 people but that's not what Texas state law says. If you kill three people, they classify you as a serial killer. So based on what Chris has told me, I don't even ask these men, by the way. I don't ask them to tell me all their crimes. What I find out, I let them, when I walk in and talk to them, I ask them, I say, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself, and whatever they choose to tell me, they tell me. You know, I'm not a judge, so I look at them personally and their sincerity, and I'll answer their questions and be God's messenger in that sense. If they choose to inform me, then I listen, and I hear from the other prisoners that I meet with tell me a lot about what they did. In Chris's case, because of the high-profile nature, I see Chris as a means to help expand the Urantia revelation, to move it forward. We haven't begun to hear the story of Chris, and I'm working on a book which he's going to be one of the main characters in the story. because his Bonnie and Clyde sort of criminal history leading to and through many spiritual experiences of a profound nature, and yet his continuing to choose to do the wrong thing, which he knows. And he describes to me the experiences he's had where he was being powerfully urged to choose something better, and he went ahead and chose the wrong thing, all the way up to death row, where maybe we can talk about it now or another time, but there have been some very interesting, I don't know, kind of like the angel of the Lord or midwayers coming and unlocking the prison doors for the early Christians and for Peter, those stories, that sort of events have happened in Chris's life, but he just continued to make the wrong choices. They have a purpose for him, and he is so high profile, and his story is so compelling. There you go.
And dramatic.
And it's something that will catch even the general public's eye. And when it's taken in its full context of this man had every opportunity with every existing religion to make these very same sorts of transformations of character, and he did not. But then after reading the Urantia book, he became so convinced as to its truth that he has established for himself the goal of becoming a mighty messenger and has made it for a year now. It's a stable change. Has so radically transformed his behavior that the other prisoners are in awe. They can't figure out what's going on. They are investigating the Urantia book, many of them, solely because they've seen what happened to Chris, solely because they've seen what he's done.
And initially, didn't they question him about, you know, like what kind of con was he pulling?
Oh, sure, and they still do. They don't see each other. You know, they rotate in this prison. There are 300 men. You know, one or two every month is dropped, and, you know, they're executed, but there are 300 men on there, and they're not – it could be years between meetings with men, all right? So
With the same person? Out in the yard.
Right. That's the only time they get to talk to each other, right, is when they get that moment out in the yard together, and that may happen.
That's right.
Very seldom. Yeah, okay.
Very seldom. Yes, they do, and he was telling me the other day that they're still, you know, they're asking him – Chris, is that you? You know, what's going on? Is this a scam? What's the con? I can't believe that this is you. This is not the person I knew. And there are men who told me they would get nowhere close to him. They would not have even the thought. They would get as far away from him as possible. When they'd be crossing each other in the hall, even in shackles, you know, there'd be three guards with each prisoner. He said they would try to get as far away from it as they possibly could. Because he scared them. And this now they're trying to find out what's going on. They're trying to come closer to him to find out, you know, what's going on, Chris. You know, we see the change in your life, and we want some of that too. And this is totally a spiritual change because, as we pointed out, he doesn't have any reason to expect there would be any change in his sentencing, so he gains nothing. There's one guy who's an atheist who has read the Urantia book and is not, well, and that's another story in of itself, which perhaps at some point we can discuss. But Chris explained to me, he said what he said to this guy is that, now look, you think that this book is not true. So what is, you know, what do you think's going on if it's not true? You think what they're going to gain something by turning us into good guys? Is that the scam here? The authors of this book, they want us to behave nicely, and that's bad, huh? You know, he said, it's very worse. You know, I'm going to go out of this as a good guy, okay? So that's where that is.
Interesting. It's all about right motivation. And if there's anything in this world that would make a person want to live right, live better, realize maybe that God's on their side and that there is some good they can do and take the sort of anger and hatefulness out of their hands, the Arranger book can do that, and we've all experienced that to some degree or another. Maybe we weren't on death row, but every person who's read it has experienced a spiritual transformation of a sort, and a healing in their heart and mind, that and understanding that this is a tough world, and there's reasons why I think bad things happen on this planet that maybe don't happen on other worlds or in other instances, but they do here, and we have to deal with it and make the most of it. And the world, as Jesus said, once, the world is not the enemy. You know, it's just men and women working together in a dispensation, you know, working to change things for the better, and that we each have our role to play. But, you know, I have to point out, for me, what Chris has gone through is typical of people, well-meaning people, who beat other young people up in the name of God. And a lot of the big orthodoxies do it. And they make people think that God is not on their side. And even as hard as this life is, God is a stern judge who's just waiting to see, you know, for his children to stumble and err so that he can see they are adequately punished. And that this is what, you know, it's like God is a sadist. And on the other hand, God is impotent. You know what I mean? He has no power. He does not do any good, whereas the devil is all powerful. And I don't think they mean to send these messages, but they do. And I think Chris is a classic example of somebody who got the message loud and clear.
Mm-hmm.
And acted it out. He was living those teachings, and now he's living other teachings. Better teachings, beautiful teachings.
And one of the things that I'd like to point out is that, you know, there are people who read the information in the Arantia book who do perhaps even understand what they're reading, but have not invested or committed to that relationship, that personal relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have a lot of intellectual data and intellectual fodder, but sadly, some of them still utilize that intellectual fodder just to beat up on other people.
That's right.
I mean, we all have seen that kind of interaction on the internet, and it's a really heart-rending experience for those of us who are really sincere about outreach ministry and the love, you know, the real message of love and brotherhood. The thing that really transformed Chris was not just the reading of the Arantia book, but it was his beginning to develop that relationship.
Absolutely.
That was spiritually transforming.
That's hitting the nail on the head. That's very true. There are lots of people who pay lip service and then don't really put it into practice. And they say, I believe this, but then they don't put that into faithful action. And Chris believed it and acted upon that belief. He had faith.
Tell us the story then about your relationship with Chris. What was your first meeting with him like, and how has the relationship grown and developed?
I'd also like
to
hear some of the stories about how he's changed, you know, other people's lives, like who, you know, his family, the guards, that kind of thing. So,
okay, the questions that we started off with is the relationship with Chris and I were dealing with. Did he have any hope? You know, was there? They're all concerned about all these guys, and Chris was the first on the list about the lake of fire. Apparently, lots of these ministers who come in there will tell them about the lake of fire, where they're going to burn in torment forever. All right, there.
Amen.
Gracious. They told
God
me
God is
that,
a good God.
That's right.
How inspiring.
That's right. And so they're saying, what is going on? Chris was concerned about this lake of fire and the second death, and he was concerned because some of these other ministers wouldn't, once they found out about his history, they wouldn't talk with him. I mean, that's a sad shame that lots of these ministers, the truth, though, they'll find about out some of the, and we talked about sex crimes, particularly those guilty of sex crimes. These other ministers won't talk to them. I mean, from these other faiths, they just, like, they drop them. They're not of any value. So Chris was concerned these other ministers wouldn't talk with him. I mean, some of these people that will come in here and see 8 people in one day, I mean, been coming up here for 20 years, and they wouldn't talk with him. So he was trying to find out, did he have any value? Was there any purpose in his existence? He had so much trouble finding truth. When he did find it in your answer book, he wanted the answer. So let's see how I can answer your questions, Paula, about my experience, particularly with Chris. He has had the background in the Baptist Fundamentalist Church. He told me of this. He told me that he wanted to... I'm having difficulty coming up with a way to answer questions about Chris. Give me... You want me to tell you about it. Can you give me a specific question? Can you possibly do that?
Well, this is Paula. What was the experience? He obviously had read the Urantia book before you met him, and he was still concerned about the Lake of Fire, which is an interesting thing to me. He still had some doubts, so he asked you specifically about his personal value and about if he could be forgiven and saved?
Yes, he did. And he said he just couldn't believe it. That's what it was. Thank you for asking the question, because that brought that to mind. He said he believed the Urantia, but he couldn't believe that he had any value, that there was just too much. He had done too many things. And I shared with him many selections out of the Urantia book. I mean, many. I couldn't even begin to tell you which ones, but many of them from the Jesus Papers. And the one that comes to mind is the one about dare to believe. I said, if you want to escape the doubt, he said he just doubted it. He just couldn't believe it. And that he had value. Not the Urantia book, but that he had value.
Right.
And I said, you know, first of all, Chris, you must dare to believe. You've got to drop the doubt. It's like with anxiety must be abandoned, doubt must be abandoned. Doubt is just going to clog the circuit, if you will. You've got to abandon the doubt. You must believe. So he listened to me, and he did. He started to believe, and he put that belief into action in his daily life. He quit worrying about whether or not he was going to survive, whether or not he had any value. He accepted that he was not going to drown in the lake of fire, because he quit doubting. He began to accept what he had been learning from the Urantia book, that God is love. And he was able to put behind himself this upbringing, this fundamentalist, well, they call themselves Christian, but it's not Christian, but the fundamentalist background that was telling him that he was not of any value, that he had made these mistakes, he was a sinner, so he was going to die. He was able to put that behind him, and by putting the belief into action, he began to reap the benefit. He sowed the seeds of belief and put them into action and began to reap the benefit of peace, understanding. He's now recently was telling me that he is finding himself at peace. He said he didn't even know what before. He hadn't even thought about peace. He was all about corruption and confusion and doing everything he could to stir everybody up. He now is finding peace. He said to me, "Bill, I now have some grasp of what they're talking about, these people trying to establish world peace." He says, "I'm beginning to understand the difficulty they face." All right? So he is finding peace. He's through acceptance and putting that acceptance, that belief into action, faithful action, abandoning doubt. These things he and I discussed. And he's coming to a new life. You'd have to see the man. Even from the period of time that I have known him, I have seen him progress from a very, very tense, very concerned. I don't know if fearful, the appearance of fearful, but he is relatively relaxed, relatively at ease. You can literally see the twinkle in his eye. I mean, he's cheerful, he's happy, and it's all because the doubt. The Urantia book gave him the information. I got him to eliminate the doubt and to believe, to put into action the belief that he was able to grab a hold of. He took that, I hesitate to call it leap of faith, but that's basically what it is, dropped the doubt and has progressed wonderfully.
You mentioned that he actually acts. What does he actually do? I mean, does he write letters? Does he... When you say he acts, is it like on a personal level? He meditates. I'm just curious about that. What actions he takes.
Within the prison community, you know, I can't see it myself, so I base what I'm saying on what he tells me and what the other prisoners tell me. He is now a friendly person who is easy to be around. And who's reaching out to help and do good to other people in every way possible. Whereas before the transformation, he was a mean person who was doing everything he possibly could to attack, confuse, disrupt, destroy. Okay?
Lash out.
Now he's friendly. And I can see when he's sitting in the booth on the other side, I can see in his demeanor, in the facial expression, you know, before he was rather tense. You know, you can just imagine a tense person. That's what he was. And now he's relaxed. And he's friendly and forthcoming and smiling. And there literally is a twinkle in his eye. I mean, it's a real person, a real sincere person, who before he said he was telling at the beginning, he was saying, you know, he couldn't feel anything. What he was asking me, that was one of the questions he asked me, was, Why doesn't any of this bother me? Why don't I feel bad about any of the things that I've done? And so we discussed that, and I explained to him about how we could kind of burn out the conscience. I mean, we could repeat the same bad behavior so many times, and we disregard the inner voice so often that we can't ultimately cease to hear it at all. And he listened, and he believed. And he has changed his behavior and his attitude. He's reaping the results. He's coming to
life.
What
about remorse? Has he gone through a period of severe remorse, or did he just kind of, did that happen?
As far as I know, no.
Huh?
No, through the numerous things that he had done, he had burned out his conscience. I mean, he really didn't have any remorse. I speculated, I wondered if he was what we in psychology would call a sociopath. That's a disorder you all probably know about it, but it's a disorder where something about the hardwiring of the brain, they just don't feel remorse for what they do.
Huh.
I don't think that's the case with Chris at all. I think he had pretty well chosen bad routes, bad behavior so many times that he had severed the connection with what mortal level of conscience that he had. He just had severed. He hadn't, from the stories he has told me, the thought adjuster has been active, and I suspect guardian angel also, all the way through this. They've been encouraging him and showing him the right choice to make, but he just kept making the wrong choices. But as far as remorse, if he has had a period of remorse, he has not shared that with me. He was concerned about the fact that he had not been, and I told him just to get beyond it, to believe in his personal value and strive to find God and to become like him, to make every choice that he can make positively with God's will of doing good to other people as the primary motivation, and just build new habit patterns and don't be worried and obsessed with what was or what could have been, but what is and what can be, okay? And so that's what he's been doing. And, he has not mentioned that there's been any period of remorse. I can recall maybe a period actually where he did, well, it was, they were tears of happiness, though. There were tears of joy. So, no, I have not seen a remorse. I don't think that he – I think that he is – he probably is remorseful at some level, but that's not been a topic of our conversation. It's not of recent because he's gone too far in the other direction. I mean, that – I've explained to him that he is involved a lot of people with his crimes, and he had tried to convince himself early on before I met him that there was some sort of predestination, and that if he had not committed the crimes that he had committed, specific murders, that these people would have gone on and they would have done all these other horrible things, which they very well may have. But I told him, you know,
he believed he was killing people who deserved to die.
In his own distorted and twisted way of thinking, yes, that is what he was. That is what he was saying. And some of that I was at the time of the commission, some of that was looking back and trying to find some justification for what he had done. And I told him, look, Chris, those were decisions you made. Those were your choices. In the one case that I'm thinking of in my mind, I said, Chris, that man is dead because you chose to shoot him in the head. And there was no predestination involved there that I can imagine. I mean, God did not tell you to shoot the man in the head. And he admitted that, you know, no, of course not. In fact, he's told me on numerous occasions about various circumstances where he felt like he was being strongly urged to make the right choice, and he knew what the right choice was, and he went right ahead and chose the wrong thing to do and committed the evil crime. So we've got him now. He's making the choices to do the right thing. He's still got a lot of bad habits. I mean, I know that he's got a lot of work to do, and I've explained he's going to work through to make this transition and continue on in the family of God. He's going to work through all these issues. He's going to have to. He's got the new habits to form, and the old habits are going to have to be worked through and rooted out. And that's between he and God and his supervisors, and now and in the life to come. You know, he's going to have to work it out. So, but it's not going to be a lake of fire. You know, he's not going to be eternally punished for eternity and tormented and all this. No, he's going to have to work through it, though. For sure.
Well, what's the most dramatic experience you've had with him since you've met him, and what are some of the stories that you would like our listeners to share?
Well, it's dramatic. There's nothing very dramatic, really. I mean, his stories of they're more general right now of the types of crimes that he committed, of his behavior, his transformation, just the very transformation is dramatic, and that's worthy of note, that a man can come from the abyss of devil worship and drug abuse and serial murder, Bonnie and Clyde sort of affair for the vast majority of his life, and make decisions based upon the message of love presented by the Urantia book authors. That's very dramatic to me. He's told me, and there's some stories that they're too complicated to give you all the details at this point, but one story briefly, on several occasions he's been in isolation at various different prisons, and this is before the death row situation, but also includes the death row situation, where mysteriously a letter, a piece of paper would appear on the floor. Now, I don't know what all this is about. I don't even know that I'm going to be able to remember what it said. But this, out of nowhere, in a situation where it's not possible, a note will appear on the floor where he is locked into solitary. And it has some comment on it about be where you are or something like that. But over a period of 30 years, since he was a teenager, this has happened three times. And this same piece of paper shows up at a time of crisis, I mean, when he's in confinement, where there's no way anybody could bring it and three different times, three different locations, the same piece of paper with the same message has shown up in his cell. Now, I don't know what that means, but that was...
What's the message again?
Well, I don't have the exact phrase. He said he realized recently he found it in a book. It's a quote from a book, but it's something about where you are is where you are, or something where you have been is where you are. It's an interesting phrase, but I can't remember exactly what it is.
Something like be here now.
Well, that's what I think, because that's the title of a book. And that's what I was, it's something like that. But where you have been is where you are, or something like that. But it's exactly the same quote, handwritten on a piece of paper that shows up in his cell. It showed up three different occasions. And it was just kind of, you know, that was a remarkable, that's something that stands out in my mind as highly unusual. I mean, why would this sort of thing happen?
Yeah.
He's gone through all these experiences, and he is positioned now. He's one of these people who is in the right position to have a powerful impact on the promulgation of the spreading of the Urantia book Revelation. By his sharing of his story, by his very transformation, he shows the power of this message in the Urantia book, the message of God's love, and that the Urantia book is the ethical revelation. It is the golden yardstick by which all other earthly revelations need to be measured. You know, they need to find the truth of the Urantia book, and his living example is a wonderful method of bringing that to the fore in the public eye. I mean, I think that the Urantia book has been, let's see, how can I say this? I think that we can do more to spread the message of the Urantia book than has been done in the last 50, 60 years. I really do.
Oh, boy. Do I hear you on that?
Yeah.
You know, everything that you've said just in the last few minutes reminds me of the story of Jean Valjean and from Les Miserables, and how one person, a minister, you know, where he had reached a level of depth and the depth of despair and was actually becoming what everybody thought he was or what everybody accused him of being. His heart essentially had died, right? He was the criminal that they made him out to be. He became the person that they convinced him he was. And even though all he was doing was trying to feed his family, and the cruelty of injustice and all of these things just hardened his heart and made him become the person that everybody said he was. And a minister, a priest, said to him, you know, you sold your soul, but I'm buying it back for you. And he gave him those silver candlesticks, right? And he went on and
he
changed his life.
Stealing. I mean, he had stolen those candlesticks.
Right. He actually had. And you know, the thing about it is, and it shows what you just said about how, you know, they obviously, our unseen friends, kept reaching out to Chris, and as they do to so many of us who have a heart. And maybe the reason we fall into this dark place is because we care and because the world doesn't. And it's no easy thing to be in the world and not of it. And as Jesus admonished us to do. And so we lose our way. We lose our way. But they still see our value, no matter what, no matter how diminished our value seemingly is. They see it, and they want to bring it out. And they know that sometimes, from the very depths of despair, like a friend of mine told me, you know, when an archer pulls the bow back, the farther back he pulls it, when he lets it go, it goes that much farther forward. Chris is like that. And they see that potential. And they see that spark that wants to be good, that wants to be valued, that wants to be valuable. And they nurture that precious spark. And I don't know. It's just so inspiring.
There's something else too in the teachings in the Urantia book that is really unique, and it is unique in all of the religious doctrines and writings on the in the world today, is the value of being in an experiential universe, and the effect of that experience on not only the individuals who are going through it, but on all of the rest of the universe inhabitants who get to share that experience, or who are inspired by it or impacted by it. They're all the way up to the Supreme Being itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no other concept in the world that that helps us to understand the value of even really negative, painful mistake experience. We somehow are the type of creatures who learn best, who learn wisdom, who gain, we're told we gain confidence from our successes. But we only gain wisdom through our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our mistakes are bigger than others. But, yeah.
That's for sure.
Well,
that's
and
true.
Once again, folks, we are down to the last 4 minutes of the show. And we've barely scratched the surface of this topic. And
but we have Bill Sadler coming back on next week. So that's good news. And maybe we can take some callers. That would be great. I'd love to allow some time for that.
Well, if people are listening, they already know, but I've wanted to share this radio show with some friends of mine, and I realized I don't know how to tell them to tune in. Is this on the Fellowship website? Is this where you turn into the Cosmic Citizen? How do you?
You can find it there, but the best way, you can find it there under the audio files, and there's a rotating box that says Listen In. The Cosmic Citizen, if you click on the box Listen In, I can also send you a link to this show. And you can find the archive of all of our shows, including our last week's show and every show going back to 2008, if you just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Cosmic Citizen. And,
forward slash
Cosmic Citizen. Okay.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Right.
We'll give you the link to.
Sure, okay. and you can go in and look at any archived show. In fact, if you were tuned in today on the website, you'd be able to go up to the browser line, just cut and paste that line, and after several minutes, maybe 15 minutes or so, this show is already uploaded as a completed show in the archive, and just using that browser line, you'll be able to bring it back up longer than half an hour later.
Mm-hmm. As the end of today's show, and in anticipation of next week's show, Andre has queued up a quote that I'd really love you to read, Andre, from the Urantia book, if you could.
I'll be glad to do that.
From the end of the book, paper 188.
Yes, paper 188, section 4, paragraph 8, page 2017, paragraph 3 in the single column book. When once you grasp the idea of God as a true and loving Father, the only concept which Jesus ever taught, you must forthwith, in all consistency, utterly abandon all those primitive notions about God as an offended monarch, a stern and all-powerful ruler whose chief delight is to detect his subjects in wrongdoing and to see that they are adequately punished, unless some being almost equal to himself should volunteer to suffer for them, to die as a substitute and in their stead. The whole idea of ransom and atonement is incompatible with the concept of God as it was taught and exemplified by Jesus of Nazareth. the infinite love of God is not secondary to anything in the divine nature.
Amen.
Amen to that.
Beautiful words from an amazing, amazingly beautiful book.
Yeah.
And so, friends, until next week, we hope you'll join us again. We'll be back with Bill Sadler. We want to hear more about his prison ministry, some personal stories of transformation. Hope you enjoyed this show. We sure did. I did. And until next week, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. And I can't wait.
Bye from the
Cosmic
Citizen.
Thanks for coming on again next week. Yes, bye
thank
from
you.
Cosmic Citizen.
Thank
and
you,
God
Bill.
Bless you as you continue your work. We'll be praying
here.
For you.
Amen.
And if we can help, let us know what we can
do. Okay.
Well, we hope this helps. We hope that there's something that may quicken somebody who's ready.
And on the last moment, Bill is doing a fundraising to support this ministry, and we will post the link for people to... It's GoFundMe.
To help out.
Right, GoFundMe.org or .com?
It's .com. I'll have to get the link. It's a complicated link, so I'll get that to you.
Okay. Well, maybe we can post that next week. But tune in again next week for more stories of Death Row Prison Ministry with Reverend Bill Sadler.
Thank you very much, Bill. God bless you.
Have a wonderful
Thanks,
week.
Thanks, listeners. Andre and Crystalline, God bless.
God bless.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.